In only a few days, we're going to be celebrating another Christmas, right? And that's our annual remembrance of the birth of the person who's absolutely the single, solitary, most influential person that the world has ever known. The respected historian, church historian, Jaroslav Pelikan, wrote a book a number of years ago called Jesus Through the Centuries. And he says this at the beginning of that work. He said, regardless of what anyone may personally think or believe about him, Jesus of Nazareth has been the dominant figure in the history of Western culture for almost 20 centuries. If it were possible with some sort of super magnet to pull up out of that history every scrap of metal bearing at least a trace of his name, how much would be left? It is from his birth that most of the human race dates its calendars. It is by his name that millions curse, and in his name, millions pray. Of course, it's customary every Christmas to hear a sermon about the birth of Jesus that usually comes from either Matthew's gospel or Luke's gospel. But I'm going to dare to do something a little different this year. Because we've been reading through the Bible, you know, and I thought, how am I going to find something that's pertinent when we're reading in Hebrews and in the end of the Bible like this? But as we're coming to the end of the year reading through our Bibles, and I've been always this year trying to preach on something that we read about the previous week. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, certainly the New Testament, everything in the New Testament builds upon the birth of Jesus, of course, but so much of the New Testament is relevant to the story of the birth of Jesus, and that's evidently certainly the case here in Hebrews chapter 1. So I want you to open your Bibles there. The whole New Testament really reveals the relevance of Jesus' birth. And in this first opening paragraph of the book of Hebrews, I think there's clear emphasis on the significance of Jesus coming into the world. And so that's what we're going to focus on today. These are our four verses that in the Greek text have 72 different words, but they're all in one sentence in the Greek. And they have received high praise for their literary excellence by a number of commentators. One said this is a magnificent introduction. Another writer said that these verses provide one of the most arresting beginnings possible, combining elegance, alliteration, rhythm, rhetorical artistry, and unstoppable force with probably the most sophisticated and stylistic Greek in the entire New Testament. Yet another says the opening paragraph of Hebrews may be the stylistic apex of the entire Greek New Testament. And then one more says, these stately lines of introduction constitute the most beautiful single passage in the New Testament. In short, then, this first paragraph of the book of Hebrews is something of a literary classic. It's sort of like a little miniature Lord of the Rings, or maybe Jane Eyre or Huckleberry Finn. But maybe that's not quite right, because it's not a work of fiction. So maybe it would be better to compare it to, say, the Declaration of Independence. But even that doesn't quite get at it, because that document, as important as it is dealing with temporal things. But the letter to the Hebrews is dealing with eternal matters, things that are going to matter forever. So in a nutshell, it speaks of how Jesus, the one whose birth we will be celebrating in a few days, is God's ultimate, indeed, he is God's final word, God's supreme revelation that surpasses all other revelations. Now, the writer of Hebrews was concerned about his readers persevering through difficult times. They were being challenged, as was common in those early days of the church, for people to be pressured to give up on Christ and turn their back upon the Christian way and go back to their old ways, and particularly to go back to living as though Jesus hadn't come for the Jewish people, to go back to all the rituals of the Old Testament and to just ignore the birth of Christ and the significance of his life and of course, of his death. But the writer of Hebrews doesn't want to see that happen, and he knows that the best way to convince people to remain loyal to Christ is to give them a correct understanding of Christ. Now, it's not possible, but if it were possible for this writer of Hebrews to come back and to visit our churches today, I think that in the main he would be largely disappointed at the lack of understanding that the average Christian has about the person of Jesus Christ. You see, many Christians, and I'm not saying they're not Christians, but I am saying that many Christians don't have a very good understanding of Jesus. They can tell you some basic things like, well, he was born in Bethlehem. His mother's name was Mary. He came to die for our sins. And those facts are vitally important, aren't they? But they are far from complete. You know, it's sort of like if you're in love with somebody and then you run into someone that you haven't seen for a while and they get to talking to you and they find out that you're in love. They say, well, tell me about this person you're in love with. If your response is something like this, oh, well, she's from Owensboro and she loves ice cream, and that's all you say, that person that you're talking to is going to wonder how well you know this person. Because you surely would be able to say more than that, right? If you're really in love. Well, that's the way it works with Jesus. If you're really in love with Jesus, you should know a little more about him than where he was born, and the name of his mother, and the reason that he came into this world. Now, Hebrews 1, 1 through 4, that we're going to be looking at here this morning, gives us a somewhat fuller picture of the person and the work of Jesus Christ. So here's what I want to do. I want to look at this under three basic statements that I want to give you. Okay, and I think that once you get these and you see how they're connected directly to the text, that it will help you to walk away from church today with a better appreciation of who Jesus really is and what he came into this world to do. So let me just give you the first statement, and then we'll look at the verses that pertain to it, and then I'll give you the second statement and the verses that pertain to it, and then the third, okay? So here's the first statement. The first statement is this, that Jesus is God's last word to humanity. Jesus is God's last word to humanity. Look at verse 1 and the first part of verse 2. The writing says, long ago God spoke to the fathers by the prophets at different times and in different ways. In these last days he has spoken to us by his Son. Well, God communicates the writer is telling us. Did you know that if God did not communicate, we wouldn't know anything about God? How would we know? He's invisible. Can't see him. How do you know he's there? How could you discover God if God did not reveal himself? But the reality is that the Bible is clear that God reveals himself in a multitude of ways. One way that God reveals himself, of course, is through nature. When you look at the beauty of the stars, the order of the planets, the way that life develops and so forth, any rational thinking person says there must be somebody behind that. That just doesn't happen. Now, there are obviously people that say, oh, well, there was a big explosion that happened, and everything came to be out of that. Well, I've seen a few explosions in my day, and never did they create order. They create disaster and a mess. But you wouldn't know that God exists, but yet God speaks. But God not only speaks through creation, God speaks in your conscience. You have this sense of right and this sense of wrong, this sense that you're going to be accountable for your actions. Where does that come from? It's God, according to the Bible. See, the reason that we know these kinds of revelations is because God has also spoken verbally through the scriptures that is recorded for us, the revelations that God gave to the prophets. And he gave a lot of revelation down through the years through the prophets. They had sometimes direct conversation. God would speak directly to people. Other times they have visions and dreams and great events that would happen. Sometimes he would send angels to talk to people about things. All kinds of different ways. And the prophets recorded these things for us. And all of that revelation was very important, but it wasn't the biggest revelation. God saved that for later. And that's who Jesus is. God's the biggest revelation that there is. Or Jesus is, I should say. He is the most complete revelation. And now that we have that, there's no need for anything else. Because what more does God need to share with us than what he's given us in Jesus? We've got everything we need in him. 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3, Peter tells us that his divine power has given us everything required for life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us by his own glory and goodness. So what more could God give? What more could he reveal? What more do we need to know? To be in a right relationship with God, to know what he expects from us, to know what his plans and purposes are and so forth, to be ready for his return when it happens, it's all there for us. So we don't need new revelation. What we need is to know the revelation we've already been given. So let me ask you a question on a practical level here. What's your plan to know the revelation of God better? I want to give you three things that might help. Number one, get a new Bible. You say, I really like my old Bible. Well, that's fine. I'm not telling you to get rid of it. But let me tell you why I think every now and again it's a good idea to get a new one. I don't know if you've experienced this before, but I certainly have. I can take a different Bible. It may even be the exact same translation as the one that I've been using. But when I look at a new layout on the page, I suddenly begin to see things I never saw before. Have you experienced that? It's the same words, but they just look different on the page. So if you're a person who uses a study Bible, maybe you should get one that doesn't have study notes in it, just because it would force you to see it differently. Or if you don't have a study Bible, maybe you'd want to get one that does have notes. Or maybe if you're a person who uses a double-column Bible, get a single-column Bible. Or maybe get one of those journaling Bibles so you can write some notes in the margin. I know that a lot of you may not take me up on that, but trust me, if you do that, you'll begin to see things that you never saw before. Well, here, let me give you another one. Get in a Bible study group. We have Bible study every Sunday morning here before we have worship. We call it Sunday school, but it's Bible studies what it is, isn't it? And if you're involved in that, you're going to learn a lot more about the Bible than if you just hear me preach. And here's another one. Wednesday night and Sunday nights. Those are other opportunities that you have to get to know the revelation of God better. What I'm saying to you is if you are serious about your love for the Lord, you say you love Him, then you need to know Him better. The more you love somebody, the more you want to know about that person. So God's given us this great revelation, and it's our responsibility and privilege to expose ourselves to it as much as we can. But we're looking this morning at Jesus and why He matters. We've said, first of all, that He matters because He is God's final revelation to us. It's another way of putting it. Let me give you a second one. Jesus is the bookends of history. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I was mentioning a Bible a minute ago. You have a Bible, I trust. It has a front cover and it has a back cover. There's a spine on the back of it, and it's all connected. And so everything within that Bible is contained within those covers, right? Well, so is all of history. All of history is bookended by Jesus. And the writer of Hebrews tells us that. Look at verse 2 again. In the middle of the verse, it says, God has appointed Him, speaking about Jesus, God has appointed Him heir of all things. That means He's going to inherit everything in the end. Everything that God has is going to Jesus. But it also says He made the universe through Him. So everything began with Jesus and everything is moving towards Jesus. Jesus is the bookends of history. See that? So Jesus is the unifying point, because He's at the front end of history and He's at the back end of history. Everything came from Him. Everything is moving towards Him. He's the creator and He is the consummator of everything. Well, the fact that everything is going to Him is a reminder to us that He is going to win the victory against everything that is opposed to Him. And you know how it goes in war: to the winner of the war, to the victor, go the spoils, right? So since everything begins and ends with Jesus, it is rather clear that He is the most important part of history. But that leads me to ask a practical question of you again. Is Jesus truly the most important part of your life? Now, here's something that you may want to try. Begin and end each day with the Lord. I read a book a couple years back, probably. has a really profound title. One word, prayer. That's the name of the book, Prayer, by Timothy Keller. And near the end of his book, he suggests some practical things to do that would help you to pray more effectively. Because prayer is communicating with God, of course. And he says, why not begin and end your day with prayer? So he suggests 25 minutes at the beginning of your day and then 15 minutes at the end. Now, there's no magical amount of time. You could adjust that time according to your schedule, add more some days, taking away, making it less other days. That's not really the most important thing. But what matters is that you begin and end your day. You're enveloping your day, in other words, by focusing upon the Lord. Now, since creation begins and ends with the Lord, it only makes sense, doesn't it, to begin and end each day with the Lord in order to remind yourself that everything comes from Him and everything is going back to Him. Okay, now there's one other statement I want to make. Okay, we've made two so far. Are you following? Remember, first one is about how Jesus is God's final word. The second one is about how He's the bookends. Everything is enveloped around Jesus. Now, here's the third one. Jesus is the best blessing that God has ever given to this world. That's what you see in verses 3 and 4. Jesus is the best blessing that God has ever given to this world. There are six reasons why that's true that he mentions. Let me quickly go through those with you. We see them right here in the text. First of all, verse 3, the Son is the radiance of God's glory. In the same way that sunlight flows out of the sun, Christ is the radiating light coming from the Father. We see God's glory in Jesus, in other words. He shows us accurately who and what the Father really is. When we see Jesus, we're seeing the Father. And the next thing is working out of that. It's very similar to it. It says He's the exact expression of His nature. The exact expression of His nature. The word that is used here in the Greek text originally referred to an instrument for engraving, but then it became something that described a mark that would be stamped by an instrument of some kind. So it means that it was generally used of a mark that you would stamp on something, like an impression that you would stamp into a piece of metal that would be used for money. See, coins have the stamp of the emperor on them. So what the writer is saying here is that Jesus, the Son, is the exact representation of God. See? So both of these first two statements are making rather similar points. That is, that if you see Jesus, you're seeing the Father because Jesus represents the Father perfectly. Okay? Now, the next thing that he says, again, that's in verse 3, sustaining all things by his powerful word. It's not simply that he's holding up the world. You know, remember Atlas, who supposedly holds the world on his shoulders? But that's a static picture, all right? He's just standing there holding the world. That's not what's being conveyed here. The idea being conveyed here is that Jesus is carrying the world along as it is progressing towards a goal. And the goal, of course, is the end of the age when we will all give an account and meet the Lord, and then he will usher in his glorious eternal kingdom. That's a far cry from the view that was common back when our country was founded, known as deism. You know that philosophy? God created the world, and he did such a good job, they said, that he doesn't even need to involve himself with it anymore. And so he made it, and then he's just leaving it alone, let it run its course. That's not what you see here at all, and nor do you see that anywhere in Scripture. No, God's hands are on his creation all the time. God's fingerprints are everywhere, and he is always actively involved, working in the world to carry out his plan and his purpose. He is sustaining the world providentially. That's what's told to us in the Bible. Not that he created and then just left it alone, but he's very involved. That's why prayer matters. That's why we look to him constantly for help. But now the writer comes to the real heart of the matter. Okay, and this gets us to why Jesus came more than anything else. Look at what he says. And again, it's in the middle of verse 3. It says, after making purification for sins. So there's another one. He makes purification for sins. You see, humanity's chief problem is that our sin separates us from God. It makes us dirty. It makes us so unclean that we are unfit to be in his presence. Sometimes around our house, we get a stain on something. And occasionally, believe it or not, occasionally I do some of the laundry. And when I'm gathering up some laundry, especially if it happens to be something that is Lori's, she'll say, well, would you make sure that you put some stain stick on that spot on my blouse or whatever? And if I don't do that, then what happens is it runs through the wash, then goes into the dryer, and that stain gets set in that fabric and probably is never coming out again. But if you take that stain stick and you rub some of that on there first and let it sit in there for a while, and then you put it into the washing machine, it's amazing how those stains get gone, how they are disappeared. Well, that's the way our lives are. You see, Jesus comes along and his blood somehow removes the stain of our sin. And so that's why he came. Are you beginning to get a picture of Jesus? But he's not finished. Notice what he says next. It says in the next part of verse 3, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. What does that mean? It means that he finished his job. When you sit down because you're done. And it's saying that Jesus completed his work. And he is now sitting in the place of high honor. And then the final thing that we read here is that he is superior to the angels. You see that in verse 4? Just as the name he inherited is more excellent than theirs. Angels are important because they are ministering spirits, and they, throughout the Old Testament era and even in the New Testament period, at times they would speak. Remember, an angel spoke to Mary and an angel spoke to Joseph. For example, But as important as they are not as important as Jesus. He is the ultimate and most important. So here in these opening four verses of Hebrews, we've got a remarkably helpful summation of the person and the work of Jesus Christ. So my hope and my prayer is that you're going to commit yourself in the days that are to come to get to know this person better. Regardless of how well you do know him, you can know him much better than you do. And he really is the center of everything. He really is. Life just doesn't make sense apart from him. But when he is the center of your life, then everything else sort of begins to make more sense. And the more you get to know him, the more you'll see that he truly is the greatest gift that you've ever received. Now, we're going to celebrate that gift that God gave right now as we observe the Lord's Supper. So our deacons are going to make their way forward right now, and I'm going to meet them down here, and we're going to celebrate the gift here as we get ready for Christmas, okay?